everybody's listening. Bye-bye.
Bye, Rodessa. And thank you to our listening audience. This has been Think Outside the Cage. I'm Jesse Bliss. Happy Sunday, and big thank you to our sound engineer, Gary Baca, and founder, Jerry Silva, and remarkable co-host, Mark Cofield. Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be.
This is Kathy Diaz, your Monday host of Global Village. Join me for an exploration of Afro-Cuban rhythms from next door and around the world with other musical stops along the way. That's every Monday on Global Village from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles 90.7 FM.
The program that you're about to hear is a rebroadcast and has previously aired here on KPFK.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. On today's program, we talk to Micha Sifri, who covers U.S. and international politics on his Substack newsletter, The Connector. That's theconnector@substack.com. And he's long written on the Middle East. Our subject today is how U.S. policy toward Israel affects both U.S. and Israeli politics. The presidential race has changed and presents the possibility of a potential shift. We'll ask Micha whether he thinks a Harris presidency could change the dynamic of the Israeli-U.S. relationship, what it will mean for Israel's war on Gaza, as well as Netanyahu's political leadership and political survival. Netanyahu's polarizing and dreadful speech to the joint session of Congress on July 24th, boycotted by half the Democratic caucus in both houses, including VP Kamala Harris, highlights the opportunity she has to win back the votes of those who threaten to stay home unless the U.S. stop funding Israel's wars, an opening that is particularly important in the swing state of Michigan. We're fortunate to have Micha Sifri with us to untangle all these threads, which constitute what he sees as the black hole of foreign policy. All this when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome back to the show. I'm Susie Wiseman. It's Beneath the Surface, and I'm very pleased to be talking today to Micha Sifri. If you read his Substack newsletter, The Connector, you'll know he is well-placed to discuss the connections he has to Israel and his particular experience in analyzing U.S., Israeli, and Middle East policy, which is our subject for today. It's been a tumultuous week politically. President Biden withdrew from the presidential race, upending what looked like a death march to a Trump-Vance victory, and the threat that represents not just to democracy domestically, but a carte blanche to Israel's Gaza genocide and rampant ethnic cleansing of Palestine, along with indifference, if not active support, for Russia's drive to turn Ukraine into another Gaza. Vice President and now presidential candidate Kamala Harris's radical speech on the Gaza humanitarian catastrophe last March at the Pettus Bridge and her remarks on July 25th after meeting with Netanyahu with many of the same notes marks a cautious note of optimism. And we're going to get Micha Sifri's views on whether he thinks the dynamic has shifted in terms of U.S. policy towards Israel. In my view, Biden's withdrawal and Harris's candidacy indicates a partial victory for the pro-Palestinian solidarity struggle, led mostly by, if not now, and Jewish Voices for Peace, sitting in and occupying to demand a ceasefire now. It's a victory because it has moved the needle of public opinion and showed that the catastrophe in Gaza can't be shoved back into the twilight. In that regard, Netanyahu's polarizing and dreadful speech or show to the joint session of Congress on July 24th, boycotted by half the Democratic caucus in both houses, including Vice President and President Kamala Harris and Biden, highlights the opportunity she has to win back the votes of those who threaten to stay home unless the U.S. stop funding Israel's war, which is particularly important in the swing state of Michigan. We're fortunate to have Micha with us to untangle all of these threads of U.S.-Israeli policy, how it affects the United States and Israel, the presidential race, and the war in Gaza, as well as Netanyahu's political leadership and political survival. So with all of that, welcome to the show. And let me just let the listeners know that Micha Sipfer is a writer who covers U.S. and international politics via his Substack newsletter called The Connector. He's long covered the Middle East, and he's the author of two books, The Gulf War Reader and The Iraq War Reader. He's visited Israel-Palestine more than 20 times, most recently this March with Americans for Peace Now. I remember that and hope that it comes back. Let's just begin with Netanyahu's speech before the joint session of Congress. It was his fourth. Mark Cooper reminded me that Winston Churchill only did two, I think. And it was a grotesque show modeled on a State of the Union address, replete with Israeli soldiers, one from Ethiopia and another who was a Muslim. So we could spend the hour on his many untruths, but what was your take if you watched?
And first of all, let me just say it's a pleasure to be here and talking with you again. This is one of those subjects that arguably I have said to people that the problem with Israel-Palestine as an issue is that it's a little bit of a black hole. That is to say, if you get sucked in, you know, the same way that if you get sucked into a black hole, you can never get out and no light escapes. You're just caught in it. And it is an issue that gets far more attention than it deserves. You know, we're talking ultimately about 14 million people between the river and the sea, right? 7 million Israelis and 7 million Palestinians. And yet the amount of attention that it consumes is enormous. But functionally, I think we need to think of Netanyahu and his appearance before Congress. I mean, it's very hard to pin this down exactly. Israel, in some ways, it's not a fully independent country. It's a little bit like the 51st state in the degree to which Israeli politics is entangled in American politics and vice versa. The amount of economic and military support that the United States has given Israel over the decades and the degree to which what happens over there influences what's happening here. To some extent, what Netanyahu's speech represents is a blunder by the Democrats on Capitol Hill who fell into a trap set for them by the Republicans. There's a bit of a competition underway between the two parties over who is better for Israel, who is better for the Jews. And Mike Johnson, who has settled into being a House Speaker, isn't just Christian fundamentalist, he's also a Christian Zionist. People may not know this, but the single largest group organizationally in America in terms of Zionist organizations that support the State of Israel is not a Jewish organization. It's the Christian Zionists of America, run by John Hagee, and they have something like 10 million members, which is more than the total number of Jews in America. So we have to recognize that part of what's going on here is the battle between the Democrats and the Republicans over, to some extent, what the evangelical community wants and believes, and also over the loyalties of American Jews, who are, even though we are a minority, a relatively small minority in population, we definitely punch above our weight, whether it's the number of Jewish Supreme Court justices or Jewish members of Congress, or how politically involved American Jews are in the process. So all of that is to say what Netanyahu came here to do was reinforce something that is getting weaker. The thing that's getting weaker is the longstanding blank check that America has written to Israel every year in the form of military aid and in the form of defending whatever Israel does in international forums like the Security Council. That has been slowly weakening over time, as the older generation, the Biden generation, if you will, that grew up with the image of Israel as this sort of scrappy miracle in the Middle East that, you know, after the Holocaust was a bit of reparations for the Jews, if you will. The younger generation today doesn't see Israel in that frame at all. It sees a very powerful regional superpower that is oppressing another people whose land it's taking. Certainly in the occupied territories, we can talk about whether that's also the case in pre-67 Israel. But the politics are shifting. From Netanyahu's point of view, the low point in the relationship came a few months ago when President Biden actually used one of the strongest levers he has, which is he said, we're going to hold up the shipment of some 2,000-pound bombs that Israel has been using in Gaza. And that was a very big signal to the Israelis. What is still unfinished is who's going to win in this battle for dominance over directing the policy over there, right? Netanyahu sits atop a coalition government that is more right-wing than has ever existed in Israel. And some key members of his coalition want the war to keep going on. They do not want to have a ceasefire. If it were up to them, Israel would be conducting an all-out genocidal war in Gaza. I would argue that what it's doing is less. It could be that, but it is not. But were it up to the far-right members of his coalition, that's what he would do. They would just wipe the Palestinians out. That's what they want to do on the West Bank as well. But Netanyahu is a cautious politician. He's always held back from these kinds of extreme steps. And the main thing that motivates him is, how does he protect his ability to stay in power? Because he's under indictment for corruption. Yeah. Right. And those cases will eventually come to an end with him probably having to serve time in prison. But as long as he's prime minister, he's immune from all of that. And so he would like to run out the clock. And if possible, his calculus, I think, is as long as the war continues, there will not be new elections in Israel, which means I will remain prime minister. And if I can hang on long enough, soon Donald Trump will be president. If that happens, you know, all bets are off, right? In terms of what will happen to Palestinians, what will happen to the whole region.
So let me come in there just for a second, because there's so much in what you've just said, Micha. Sure. And that is, first of all, I was asking for your take on the speech. You opened up into, in fact, the whole internal situation in Israel, but also Netanyahu's leadership is different than others. One is that his arrogance, he thinks that he is the tail that wags the dog and that he can determine what happens in the U.S. and that he's also more partisan than any other Israeli leader in that he openly wants and shows that he wants Trump in power. So, and he comes to Congress. You know, I want to get back to the internal situation in Israel, but let's first talk about what's happening here and how it's affecting us.
Because I'm with you on that, Susie. All I'm saying is, unlike almost any other part of the world, these places are in a symbiotic connection where they influence each other a lot more. It isn't there and here so much because of all of these connections. The degree to which Israelis have invested, with a lot of help from various forces in the United States, ranging from the American Jewish community to the evangelical community, in influencing our internal politics, right?
Right, right.
We're really caught in a web of relationships, and it's very hard to disentangle them. The degree to which Israelis obsess over the smallest changes in the tenor of what American politicians are saying about them, for example, tells you how much we matter to them. And the degree to which American politicians are invested in seeming to be on the right side of Israel, whatever that means, also shows you how influential it is in American politics. So it's all tied up together in an ugly, messy knot, and it's very, very hard to separate them.
So the fact that you had, you know, neither Biden nor Harris attending the speech, mm-hmm. and half of the Democrats in both houses, showing that there is a marked difference this time, that everything you just said about how that relationship has changed. But we should also say that the U.S. relationship with Israel and support for the right-wing coalition's war in Gaza was threatening Biden's reelection, and now he's withdrawn. And in many ways, that's kind of lifted a weight in terms of election here. But I wonder if you think that Harris's candidacy changes the dynamic on U.S.-Israeli policy. And perhaps we could reference both her speech last March at the Pettus Bridge that was really a radical statement, as radical as you could possibly hope for on the war. And then, you know, her statement yesterday in which she once again talked about the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza and calling for an immediate ceasefire. And she also raised the issue of Palestinian right to self-determination, freedom, security, and statehood. So even though, you know, her speech, I think, was slightly more measured or balanced now that she's the candidate than it was last March, the real question is what change in policy you think it hints, or is it just about winning back the votes of those in the pro-Palestinian movement and the Arab constituency who threatened to sit out the election?
You know, it'll be really interesting to see in the coming days, because I think we're talking about a moving train. The explosion of support for Harris since Biden's withdrawal has astounded and delighted, I think, everybody on the whole center left, for the most part, who just were terrified that Biden was going to lose to Trump. And what we don't know yet is what the upper limit of that is. And so, you know, some of what you're asking me about, which is how much will the issue of Gaza matter in November? I mean, there are two variables that we just simply can't predict. One, let's say Harris keeps rising, right? The early polling shows, both among young people and among Black voters, the intention to vote has gone up by double digits in just the last few days. And she's having these massive online conference calls. My wife was on one yesterday for white women. It was more than 100,000 people on a Zoom. You know, this is all trigger, you know, Sunday night. Within hours of Biden's withdrawal, there were 44,000 Black women on a Zoom. So it could be that by November, the race looks very different. And 100,000 votes in Michigan, which is what really we're referring to here, the state that's most in play because of the war is probably Michigan. And there's definitely an Arab American and Palestinian community there that is in deep pain, to the point where people have already said that they can't see themselves voting. Well, they said they wouldn't vote for Biden. We have to assume that feeling will probably not go away. But it may not matter as much if the polls shift in a continuing way in Harris's direction. The other thing that may change is the war itself. We may finally see a ceasefire, a release of the hostages, the withdrawal of the Israeli army out of Gaza, flooding in of more humanitarian aid, all sorts of things that will begin to turn the page on what's been a very, very painful and divisive conflict. So we just don't know. I thought the most interesting thing about Vice President Harris's statement yesterday after she met with Netanyahu, there were two things, really. The first one, absolutely, the tenor, it's not so much that her policy is that different from Biden. She is 100% supporting the effort to bring this ceasefire into existence, but she definitely seems to show more empathy for Palestinians.
Yeah,
I think Biden, his blind spot was always a failure to recognize that all human lives are precious and that the trauma that Israelis experienced, which was horrible on October 7th, we have to see both, right?
Yeah.
And you'd never really felt from Biden the same kind of visceral empathy.
Well, he even doubted the figures. Remember when they first came out?
He was responding defensively because, after all, he embraced Netanyahu. You know, I think Biden miscalculated and gave far too much support to Netanyahu. He should have held back and actually let Israelis do what they would have done, which is thrown him out of office in the days right after October 7th, had the United States not come in and given him this embrace. But that's water under the bridge. The other thing that Harris did, which I thought was interesting, but I can already see is not resonating unless it's really reinforced. She went out of her way at the end of her remarks yesterday to ask everybody to recognize that this issue is not a binary, meaning she wants people to be able to see that you can be both pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli, and that where we have been stuck for the last 8-9 months, and this is certainly what I've been writing a lot about, is that we have, in the broad Democratic capital D ecosystem, we've become polarized against each other over this issue. And it's reached a point where both sides, it's not like we have an anti-war movement. What we have are two pro-war movements, one that wants Palestinians to win and one that wants Israelis to win, which I think is a terrible strategic place to be, because that fundamentally, number one, that can't work. 7 million Israelis are not leaving the land between the river and the sea, and 7 million Palestinians are not leaving either. And all efforts to enable one to win over the other one are just adding fuel to this endless conflict. That middle ground, which is non-binary, which is saying basically that there is justice to both claims to the land, and that there has to be a way to share it, whether that's partition or some kind of binational federation, whatever, remains to be seen. But we're not going to end this with some kind of clean, you know, one side completely vanquishing the other one. And this is where Hamas and Netanyahu are like actually in alliance with each other.
For sure. Go on.
And,
yes.
Yeah. And that where both of them, each, they thrive because they can point to the other one and say, you see, my enemy just wants to destroy us. We can't let that happen. So everything we do is justified. They reinforce each other. And the United States is in this weird, almost, I don't want to use this word inappropriately because I know we shouldn't say this anymore, but American policy towards the region is so contradictory, right? On the one hand, the United States says it favors a two-state solution. On the other hand, we keep enabling the Israeli right wing to further and further annex more territory. Biden has done a tiny little bit towards attacking the settlement movement. You suddenly you're like, why haven't they done this all these years? We could have been withdrawing, putting sanctions on settlers, and making it harder for them, for their organizations to raise money in the United States. Let's take away their ability to move through the financial system. I mean, we could do a lot to undermine the settlement movement if we really wanted to. Again, power politics here being what they are very, very cautious about doing that. So I'm heartened by Harris saying it's not a binary. I think what she's trying to signal there is, I got to win this election, folks. And if you keep insisting that I have to pick a side, I'm not going to pick a side. On the other hand, I do think it's important, and it is a shift away from the sort of automatic only pro-Israel. And that reflects what's changing in the Democratic Party. For half the members, or roughly half, to either openly boycott Netanyahu's speech or, oops, have some scheduling conflict and do something else is a very, very important shift. But it won't be enough for people in the Answer Coalition or people who view Israel as a illegitimate settler colonial project that has to be wiped off the face of the earth. I mean, we have to recognize that on the left, there are also these different trends, and some of which are demanding a maximalist solution to the conflict, which I think the mainstream of the Democratic Party is not going to embrace.
I think I want to just come in there just a minute on that, because, you know, I think even my own trajectory or thinking on this issue, you know, I've always sort of been opposed to any kind of theocracy and said a democratic secular state is the only one that would actually function. But of course, you can say anything you want from here, but it has to come from the people who are living there. And, you know, one of the things that came out of Harris's remarks, and I think you're absolutely right in the way that you characterize them, is that she put forward, again, Biden's three-stage proposal for a ceasefire. And then, as you said, and I'm glad you did, said we can't see it as a binary. She then stressed the two-state solution. And we both know there's little appetite for that. But in reference to what you just said about the left, is that you just have to recognize the facts on the ground. There is no disappearance of either population. Perhaps Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and some of the others in their fantasy thought maybe they could push all of the Gazans into Egypt and all of the West Bank Palestinians into Jordan and somehow reclaim it. But that's also not going to happen. So, you know, you're stuck with reality and then you have to move from where reality is. So in that light, so what do you think of this? And also, you know, you've mentioned so many things and I want to go into it when we talk more about Israel. I actually think, and I'm not so sure about this, but I think when push comes to shove in November, even those who are adamant that they won't support any Democratic candidate, they might as well be voting for Trump, and the Trump solution is antithetical to anything that they represent. I can't ask you to get inside their head, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that Harris changes the conversation for those people and offers them an off-ramp, and she may carefully build that off-ramp. There are lots of subtle signals that she can send. She, at the same time, has to hold the broader coalition together. So this, some of this is just a matter of, you know, the art of politics. I think some of the people who are so angry, again, let's go back to Michigan and the folks who built, there are people who said vote uncommitted in the primaries, and there were about 10 to 12% or roughly in a number of primaries who used that to send a signal.
Yeah.
But we didn't have another candidate running that was explicitly talking about Palestine or Gaza or any of those things that where we could say for sure these are the voters for whom that matters the most. I suspect some of them are already third-party voters. In other words, Cornel West, Jill Stein, some of those people maybe were never Democrats, right? We have every reason to worry that third-party votes could spoil the election in key states. And at the same time, we should also realize there are some people who have never in the past voted Democratic either. So if the Green Party gets 1% in Michigan, it may not matter. Okay. But it seems to me that, yes, we're spending an hour talking about this issue, but the average Democratic voter or even the average young voter, this is not their number one issue. The Harvard Institute of Politics does one of the best surveys in the country of the youth vote. And they asked young voters about what their top issues were. And Gaza was like way down near the bottom. It is a subject of intense concern for maybe 20% of the electorate, maybe, compared to a lot of bread and butter issues, inflation, jobs,
housing, all of it.
And, yeah, you know, rising rents, you name it. And so I think that it was an incredibly hot issue after October 7th, because it was unavoidable. You know, you can't avoid the images of, you know, whole apartment blocks being blown up and the number of civilian casualties was horrifying. That's not what's happening now. So I think this election is not going to turn on what's happening in Gaza, though the Middle East is still the Middle East. And you know, there are lots of people who might want to screw with that, starting with Iran, which is a malevolent actor. This regime in Iran is not unlike other regimes that maintain their legitimacy by giving their people an enemy to focus on, an external enemy. And the Iranian regime hates the United States and hates Israel. So are they going to try and influence the election in some way? There was even that story about supposedly Iran sending a team to the United States to try and assassinate Trump. So we really don't know. But if things stay on what you might call a normal course, I don't think the election is going to be decided on this alone. I think for the health of the left in America, for the health of all of us who are striving to turn this country in a better direction and avert not just what Trump wants to do with Project 2025 and all of that, but, you know, let's finish what Biden started, right? Like, he started to invest in America. He started to rebuild our infrastructure. He started to figure out how to shift more resources toward social needs. And I think Harris very much would like to be able to do those things. For us to be able to get moving in that direction again, we need to be unified. We need to find a way to get this issue to stop dividing us so much, right? Again, to go back to the point that Harris made about it not being a binary, the more we press on one side of the binary or the other, the worse the Democratic coalition performs. That to me is the way, you know, where I land on the politics of all of this. When October 7th happened, the first thing I saw going on was how relationships on the progressive left were suddenly shattering. At the personal level up to the leadership level, people were suddenly in shock that people who they thought were their allies were not their allies, and that we actually disagree about this issue. Now, it's okay to disagree, but not to the point where then we can't work with each other, right? And even if we don't agree about what words to use to describe Gaza or exactly what policy a Democratic White House should be taking on the Middle East, we've got a lot of other things to work on as well. And a practical person would say, and by the way, most Americans would rather that we focus on those things too. So,
which is also, you know, why it would be great if there could be a ceasefire before the election.
Oh, yes.
Not just for everyone in the region, but, you know, for our own election as well. But, you know, I want to move into, because, you know, I agree with you on all of this, and specifically as well, I mean, it's a whole different conversation about the left's relationship to what we call bourgeois politics, you know, and that, you know, I think it takes a certain understanding that in any system that is first past the post or winner takes all, you can vote your conviction, but it's just not part of the game. And so once you realize it's a rigged system. Yeah, well, I mean, I always did. I refused to vote Democrat for so long, and then I realized it's a rigged system. So if you really want, you know, you have to just be strategic.
Your capacity as a citizen doesn't begin and end in the 5 minutes you spend in the voting booth.
Exactly.
There's so many other ways to organize, to influence the process, and to shift the direction of the country. The amount that we obsess over our vote, as if the vote is this
part of the way we're socialized, right?
Yes. You're right.
Yeah, well, I want to move, actually, because I know we're going to have so much to say, and you're so good on this issue of internal Israeli politics. So I want to know, you know, first of all, how you think Netanyahu's speech was received in Israel, and beyond that, if and what anything it might mean, you know, in terms of the attitude of the Israeli Jewish population toward the Palestinians in the Gaza war. And we should probably preface it by reminding the listeners that we have seen impressive, spectacular demonstrations over a longer period against Netanyahu's government, especially when he, you know, was trying to impose judicial reform in order to keep himself in power and out of jail. And then when the war started, you know, there was some quiet on that. And now, once again, we're seeing gigantic demonstrations. And I think I saw I heard on PBS that fully 75% of the population in Israel opposes Netanyahu, whether they oppose, you know, his policy or just the way he's carrying out the war or his refusal to take seriously the importance of getting the hostages back right now. Let me hear all of that from you and we can see where it goes.
Well, look, I was in Israel, Palestine for 3 weeks in March. Part of that time was on a 8-day trip organized by Americans for Peace Now. which is a liberal Zionist group that is closely aligned with the Israeli Peace Now movement, primarily an anti-settlement movement, anti-occupation movement. And it was like any visit there, it was fascinating and challenging at the same time. Israeli Jews, let's remember 20% of Israel's citizens are Arabs, and they may turn out to be the linchpin of Israel at some point in the future becoming better integrated in the Middle East. Put that to the side for the moment. Israeli Jews are hyper-traumatized. They are not out of the trauma of October 7th. They are caught in it. Some people there even say, well, what's today's date? It's October 246. You know, they're reliving that day. And I don't know if Americans can understand this, really. You know, this is a mass casualty event on a scale many times bigger than what 9/11 was. There are still something like 100,000 internal refugees in Israel who are not able to live in their homes, either near the border with Gaza or near the border with Lebanon. In the United States, that would be like 12 million people displaced. So there's no normalcy there, number one. Number two, their media is completely focused on that trauma and the war, but only the war from the perspective of what's happening to them, right, not what's happening to Gazans. Hebrew media is, you have to go to the international media, you have to make a conscious choice to learn what else is going on. It's not, again, unlike after 9/11, when if you were an opponent of invading Iraq, I mean, Phil Donahue was thrown off of MSNBC for questioning the war. It's the same terrible rally round the flag effect.
But it's even worse. Let me just interject, because, you know, I have a go-to guy in Israel, Yoav Pellet, who I normally talk to. He's brilliant in his analysis. After October 7th, I said, let's talk about what's going on in Israel. And he said, I can't. His sister was fired from her position. She was finally reinstated. He said, but there's so much internal repression now, yeah, and censorship, that it's just not safe to be a critical voice. That goes farther than it is here. I don't know if it's still the truth.
I would say there's plenty of, I mean, certainly Haaretz and 972 magazine, there, yeah, there is, the left is available to Israelis in Hebrew. It's not being censored. But I was just trying to say as a prefix to how is Netanyahu viewed.
Yeah.
The crazy thing is, he is not popular at all. He is deeply hated for a variety of reasons, including he's just a smarmy, self-possessed, corrupt man who's trying to hold on to power, but also because he's seen as largely responsible for allowing October 7th to happen. He propped up Hamas. He thought he had everything under control, and he still hasn't taken any responsibility for it. He has never visited the kibbutzim along the southern border that were all devastated. The American consulate and embassy in Israel has probably spent more time meeting with hostages than the Netanyahu government, hostage families. So yeah, he's reviled to the point where several people actually even said to me, you know, if I could, I would just get a machine gun and I would kill him. That's how intense the hatred of him is personally. But he's presiding over a war that's popular.
That's the contradiction I want you to talk about, yes, because the question is whether the people hate him or hate his policy.
No, they hate him. And there's a lot of evidence now that Israelis are getting closer and closer to envisioning a post-Netanyahu government that would probably be led by Naftali Bennett, who is the previous prime minister, who also is right-wing. But he calls himself a right-wing liberal, which is to say he's liberal on social issues, but he's also more pragmatic and far more likely to embrace a deal that Biden has been offering, which is, you know, I'll give you Saudi Arabia, you just give us a pathway to some kind of Palestinian state. And by the way, the Saudis will pay for reconstructing Gaza, which is not a small consideration.
Wow.
So the public is ready to move on, but they are not. This does not mean that suddenly the left in Israel is reviving. I would say while we were there, we got a great briefing from Dalia Scheindlin, who's a pollster who writes for Haaretz a lot. And she said, look, the Israeli left has been decimated since the Second Intifada. The Oslo peace process broke down at the end of the 90s, and Arafat and Barak failed to come to terms on a final deal. And then Hamas started really escalating the suicide bombings, and Israelis decided that there was no one they could trust on the Palestinian side. And leftists in Israel, who are people who support a peace deal with the Palestinians that involves giving them a state, saw their position crumble. And they are at most 10-12% of the population on the Jewish side now. And maybe 60% of Israeli Jews are right wing. And then you have another 20, 25, 30% who are in the center. The thing is that the right wing Israelis are split. Not all of them are hyper religious. Not all of them are settlers. They just don't see who they can make peace with. And what Hamas did on October 7th has made things worse, because they look at, well, we gave them back Gaza, and instead of building a thriving Singapore on the Mediterranean coastline, what did they do? They invested all their money in building these tunnels underground so that they could eventually attack us. And the type of attack also, if Hamas had only attacked military targets, there might be a different conversation. But in Israel, the trauma is, you know, that they attacked families and children and old people.
And concert goers.
And concert goers. And by the way, not just Jews, they attacked Bedouin and their Palestinian victims.
Thai workers and I mean, everything. And also, like, I'm sure I just want to say it for the listeners that the kibbutzim nearby were pro-peace. And, you know,
most of them were pro-peace.
They were kind of lefties, you know, is so much as it exists. So, well, what does this really mean, though? You said he's deeply hated. He's all of the things that you just said, Micha, about Netanyahu. And that most Israelis want him gone. What will it take to make him gone? Because he managed to squeak by after, what was it, 5 elections in a year and a half, assembling these coalitions. So what are his prospects for remaining in power, and how does he do it? And why can't, you know, there be some sort of no confidence or something like that?
Well, 64 out of 120 is a pretty healthy majority in Israeli coalition politics. And one of the reasons why that majority has held is the current polling shows that if they were to have new elections, those parties would shrink and they might only have about 45 or so seats. So you have a lot of members of the Israeli Knesset who understand that they're dead men walking, right? Yeah. Like if they do the right thing for the country and vote no confidence, some of them won't be coming back. So to some degree, it's like asking, how do you get Israelis to do what Biden just did, right? Which is abdicate for the good of the country. And in the American case, well, the debate performance showed everybody that Biden was not getting better. He was only getting worse. But then we had this swarm of donors and elected officials and a tremendous amount of pressure brought to bear on him. And the same type of pressure has been brought on Netanyahu, and he refuses to budge. And this is a problem. Like he's under no requirement to have new elections until I think sometime in late 2025. So the only way his government falls is if some of the internal pieces of it pull themselves out. It might break.
You mean the right-wing parties? Because what does it mean that even the military leadership is opposed to him and are opposed to his conduct of the war? Right-wing leaders.
Yes. But Israel has no tradition of military coups, and it's highly unlikely that would start now. It could break over it's an important issue in Israel, but it's sort of shocking to, you know, have to discuss it in our context, which is over whether or not ultra-Orthodox yeshiva students will be drafted into the army. The army needs, it's roughly 13% of the population, of the Jewish population, is ultra-Orthodox, and they are exempt from military service by virtue of the fact that they are all studying Torah and yeshiva. And this is deeply resented by the rest of the Jewish population that carries the burden. And in many cases, you have people who have, it's not just the draftees in the regular army, but the people who do reserve duty, and many of them have been pulled away from their families and their jobs for months on end. So this question of when will the ultra-Orthodox carry their weight is reaching a boiling point, and the leaders of the ultra-Orthodox parties have said, we will never, you know, allow it to happen, that our boys will be drafted. Why are they afraid of this? There are two reasons. The first one is there's just a lot of money tied up into government subsidies to all these yeshivas. They get paid a certain amount of money based on the number of people who are supposedly studying. Many of them never even show up to study. It's all very corrupt. But the other reason is a harder one, which is they are terrified that if their boys go into the army, they will not come back ultra-religious.
Interesting.
That, in fact, serving in the army, even though there are Orthodox units that they can serve in, will secularize them. And this is one of the several problems that Israel has internally, is that it's sooner or later they're going to have to face this. And they've been subsidizing what was originally a very tiny minority, but now is the largest growing segment of the Jewish population is ultra-Orthodox.
But I thought that they already passed that law or whatever it is that said that they will no longer be able to escape military service. So what's the state of play on that?
Well, they've begun sending draft notices to a few thousand people. That doesn't mean any of them have yet been pulled in. They, you know, there's a bureaucracy to this. It will take several months. And again, you know, Netanyahu has been a political genius at deferring and delaying solving any of these hard problems for as long as possible. But this is the one that people think could really be the breaking point for the government, because if a different right-wing party in formation comes along and basically says, look at the polls, as soon as there are new elections, we will displace Netanyahu. And oh, by the way, ultra-religious parties, we'll solve your problem for you. Support us, bring down the government, and don't worry, we'll take care of you. You can see a way that you know, it's not pretty, but it could be the pathway to Netanyahu's downfall, which would be the source of great rejoicing in Israel. There is, in the same way that being released from Biden as our, you know, nominee has unleashed a lot of energy, I think in Israel that would also open up the political scene there in a way that is currently, it's all bottled up. That and a ceasefire. I mean, the understanding there is when the war is over, like right now, the polls in Israel show that 44% of Israeli Jews think Netanyahu should resign now, and another 28% think he should resign as soon as the war is over. So he's been delaying ending the war, but functionally, this war is almost over. Certainly in Gaza, it's almost over. But again, let's, you know, remember this horrible alliance of extremists that includes Iran, Hezbollah, which is one of Iran's proxy armies, which is in southern Lebanon, and Hamas. And they also get a vote in trying to keep things going because it serves their interests as well. So I don't know if we get out. Like I said to you at the beginning, it's a black hole. You get sucked in and there's no really easy way to escape.
Let me ask you this question before you finish that thought. And sorry for the interruption. But do you know, you mentioned that the opposition is focused on, you know, the person of Netanyahu, and that Naftali Bennett is also still on the right, but would be in favor of a ceasefire. And, you know, so the question is, though, does the Israeli population show any opposition to continued occupation and more of the same? Or are they at the point where they're willing to consider, you know, that the present model is not a solution and does not bode well for their future, especially after October 7th?
Well, I think what the optimistic answer is, that October 7th proved that the strategic decision that Israel had been operating under for the last 15 years, which is that it can just separate itself from the problem, right? Build a wall between Israel and Gaza, build a wall between Israel and the West Bank, and the Palestinians will just deal with, you know, suffering under the circumstances that they're imposed, that have been imposed on them. Nope, that's not working. October 7th broke that conception. What will replace it, right? So one answer is what the right wing wants, which is to resettle Gaza and to push the Palestinians out, either immediately or by attrition. And maybe 30% of the Israeli public supports that vision. The rest, wow. I think, you know, there have been polls that show a slim majority, maybe just a little over 50%, in favor of the Saudi deal. And the Saudi deal isn't just an end to the war and normalization of relations with, you know, this very important Sunni power, which Israel, by the way, strategically needs because its main adversary is the Shiite regime of Iran. And so, you know, you talk to Israeli military strategists and you know, the sort of policy wonks on this, they all think this is in Israel's strategic interest. But there has to be some path towards a Palestinian state. And the problem is that Israelis right now,
they don't want it.
Well, they fear it because they don't believe that there won't be another, you know, attack like what happened on October 7th when Israel's defenses were completely overwhelmed and the cost was tremendously high and tremendously painful for them. And I think that it's too soon. I mean, if it were up to me, yes, of course, that's the only ultimate resolution possible is we have to divide this land and it has to be shared and Palestinians have to have a state alongside Israel. But Israelis, you know, the last time I can remember Israelis believing in that possibility was like 1999, when they thought they were on an irreversible path towards normal neighborly relations. And then suicide bombings and the breakdown in talks left them feeling like there was no path forward. So we have to recognize how hard it is to get people to begin to trust again after everything that's happened. And we haven't talked at all about whether Palestinians would also, you know, be willing and able to move in that direction too. We need a new generation of leadership on the Palestinian side, which has been suppressed.
Right. And also, I mean, there are historical examples of very traumatized people, you know, I think of the Congo, you know, under Belgian rule, where after, you know, 10 million were killed, they somehow were able to come out of that and not just continue the cycle. But this is a particularly difficult problem. And we, you know, do you have a short little, you know, couple of sentences on what you think the Palestinian side is thinking now? Because I'm thinking that they're just so traumatized, but there's definitely going to be a whole generation now who hate Israel even more.
Well, I would think that Palestinians may also want to have a reckoning with Hamas, which dragged them into this. And, you know, that you certainly do hear from Gazans, both inside Gaza as well as in Egypt, the ones who have gotten out, a lot of anger towards Hamas for taking them this way. But they've never really been able to develop their own politics because they are under sort of two systems of police control, one Palestinian and one Israeli. So we don't really know. I think that the answer is, if you take away all reason for people to hope for a better future, they will absolutely turn towards violence. And what we have to reverse that. There is a movement inside Israel itself, which is led, by the way, both by Palestinian Arabs and Palestinian Jews, called the Shared Society Movement. And these are people who effectively say, look, we can't keep repeating this cycle of violence on each other. You know, it's led in many cases by bereaved Israeli Jews and bereaved Palestinian Arabs who have lost family members either to terrorism or to Israeli action. That all of that is where I think we have to invest more energy and more resources. In the same way that, you know, in Northern Ireland, how did that conflict end? Well, it ended because both sides got exhausted by the violence. They realized that it was not getting them anywhere. And everybody figured out how to reinforce the moderates on both sides and weaken the extremists. Right now, the extremists, whether it's Netanyahu or Hamas, are the ones in the forefront. And we have to keep thinking and doing things that will weaken them, not strengthen them. So what happened this past week in Congress was not good in that respect, because the U.S. Congress chose to, you know, give one of those two extremists a major platform and a boost when that was the last thing we actually needed to do. And the only silver lining is a lot of elected officials, mostly Democrats, chose to stay away. But it didn't help. Didn't help. And, you know, hopefully we can now turn the page on this ridiculous man, Netanyahu. We can maybe get to a ceasefire. And who knows? You know, I'm moderately hopeful that Harris has a better chance knitting the Democratic coalition back together that's been so divided over this issue. But we're still in very dangerous territory. And, you know, the sad thing is even if you try to ignore the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it doesn't go away.
You know? Right. Well, I think you can. I think everything you've just said is excellent. But there is that one point that there was a period, what, 6, 7, 8 years when you didn't even hear about the Palestinian Israeli conflict. And that was, of course, the Trump years. But other, you know,
also
it just
the early you know, Biden.
Yep. Biden. Right. So you could say that, you know, this terrible war and this terrible catastrophe that is brought out. You know, it's so changed the direction of the 21st century in ways, along with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that were unthinkable just 20 years ago, at least, you know, to my notion. But right now, I think you are seeing at least a glimmer or, you know, of hope that this will be, you know, that things will go back on track, at least hopefully.
Well, we're not going back to any quiet period. We're now deep in the turmoil, and the only way through now is to get to some kind of, you know, more just and comprehensive solution. That's what whoever the next president is going to be dealing with. So let's hope for the best.
Mika Sifri, thank you so much for your thoughts. We'll come back. We'll do it again. You know, this thing isn't over, and when it is, I'll want to talk to you. You can subscribe to Mika Sifri's Substack. It's a newsletter called The Connector, where you'll see all of his thoughts on these issues. He's a longtime writer who covers U.S. and international politics, and especially the Middle East. He's the author of two books called The Gulf War Reader and The Iraq War Reader. And as you heard, he has visited Israel-Palestine more than 20 times, and most recently this march with Americans for Peace Now. And you know, I'm very glad, Mika, that you ended on at least that somewhat hopeful note.
Thanks. Always have to be hopeful.
Well, I totally agree. Thanks for being with us today.
Susie, great to
thank
see you.
And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Mika Sifri. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor and engineer Juliana Gota, and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
The program that you just heard was a rebroadcast. It previously aired here on KPFK.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. Yes, the phone number is 818-985-5735. We're in our summer fun drive, and we're asking you to go to your phones. If you've been experiencing the station cutting in and out, if you're listening in your car on your radio, we are experiencing some problems at our tower in Mount Wilson. The power is going out. It's something going on with Edison. So we're encouraging people to go online for uninterrupted broadcasting. 818-985-5735. We're still taking your pledges. You can donate online at kpfk.org. Once again, we'd like to make the announcements that we are having some technical difficulties at our transmitter.